This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, exploring pressing public management issues facing us today. I'm Michael Keegan, your host. Over the past 15 years, the IBM Center for the Business of Government has sought to connect public management research with practice. We do this by sponsoring independent third-party research from top minds in academia and the nonprofit sector, hosting weekly conversations on the Business of Government Hour with government executives who are changing the way government does business and pulling the best insights from these efforts to craft each edition of the Business of Government magazine. Our aim is to help government leaders effectively respond to their mission and management challenges by producing practical, actionable research while also offering these same leaders a platform from which they can inform, share, exchange, and learn from each other. This edition of the Business of Government magazine surveys a variety of public management issues facing us today. Whether it's leading in the so-called new normal of doing more with less, or how the lack of resources drives the need to innovate, collaborate, or change the way we do business, some may say buzzwords abound. What we seek to do is go beyond the buzz, to introduce and connect our readers to actual public sector executives who are leading agencies or initiatives that are focused on critical missions. These leaders profiled in this edition offer compelling insights, lessons learned, and most of all, advice to others that is marked by clarity of mind and a sense of purpose. First up, conversation with leaders. The three government executives featured represent an array of disciplines and agencies with a single constant. They are all making a difference. David S. Ferriero, Archivist of the United States, leads the National Archives and Records Administration, which is more than just the nation's keeper and protector of records.
Our mandate is to collect, protect, and encourage the use of the records of the government so that people have the opportunity to primarily hold their government accountable, to learn from our past as we make decisions about the future. So that's broadly what the mission is.
It is the steward of the American story, preserving the past to protect the future. The records it holds are the original sources of the story, documenting the collective history of our nation through the actions of individuals and institutions.
Wonderful story about the records of the White House used to be stored in the garage on the White House grounds. Fire in the garage. Rutherford B. Hayes out there on the lawn and a bucket brigade trying to put the fire out. And so stories like that about how the records were being treated. The British burned the town. So the fact that the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights were spirited out of town the night before the British burned, it's a miracle that the things we have survived. So our collection starts with those journals of the Continental Congress, the oaths of allegiance signed at Valley Forge by George Washington and his troops, all the way up to the tweets that are being created in the White House as we speak right now. So it wasn't until FDR, actually, the Roosevelt administration, that the country actually got serious about creating the National Archives. And he created the National Archives and the Presidential Library System at the same time.
Yet changes in the federal government, in society, and in the nature of records themselves have prompted the National Archives to change the way it does business. David Ferriero, Archivist of the United States, elaborates on the challenges that have prompted his agency to change the way it works.
Electronic records, electronic records, electronic records. It's clear to say that the biggest challenge, as you heard just from the magnitude of what we're up against, is this transition from paper to electronic. and it's making the paper environment look really good. So it is clearly it's electronic records. It's ensuring that the agencies are creating, they're using the technology in a way that ensures that the records are going to be available 100 years from now, so that people can have the same opportunity to hold their government accountable, learn about the history of the country through the records. So ensuring that they're being created in the appropriate way and preserved, taken care of, and transferred to the National Archives at the appropriate time. So we have, just to give you an example, this is, a huge complex issue, but just one little piece of it. For some agencies, it's 20 or 30 years that the records stay within the agency. And that works in a paper environment. It doesn't work in an electronic environment. It makes me really nervous to think about 30 years' worth of electronic records sitting, in the outside of the National Archives. Changes in technology, just the ability to read those over time is a huge challenge. So we have created something called the Electronic Records Archive within the National Archives, which is the facility that ingests those 2 to 3% of the electronic records at the appropriate time. We're incredibly fortunate to have the attention of this administration around records management. The president in November issued a memorandum on records management, which authorized me and the director of OMB to issue a directive to the agencies, spelling out a certain set of requirements for each agency, especially around electronic records. So it's the first time since the Truman administration that a presidency and administration has gotten involved in records management. So it's a really exciting time for us, and I'm confident that we're gonna nail this one.
What's the National Archives strategy for getting all this right? Ferriero elaborates.
The strategy in terms of doing that has to do with thinking about, and we're going through this process right now, as a result of the new records management directive, rethinking the concept of record, exactly what is a record, what needs to be preserved, how it is preserved, and ensuring, as I've said, that it's going to be available in 100 years and more. And each one of those aspects has a separate set of strategies involved. The preservation piece of it, for instance, is huge, just because we barely understand preservation around paper. That's something that we think we've got that nailed. Preserving electronic information is much more complicated. We've been experimenting with our early electronic records. There are lots of formats, obsolete formats, that need to be preserved. So identifying, in terms of strategies, identifying logical partners to be working with internally and externally, and this is something that's new to the National Archives, identifying best practices within the government, within industry, within universities to help us solve this problem. But the fact that we've got the administration and OMB on board gives me great hope.
There is also great hope in building this country's resiliency in the aftermath of disasters and emergencies. As we have seen from recent emergencies and disasters, there is always an impact on the public health and medical care. Strengthening the country's public health preparedness and response takes many forms and complementary efforts. Pursuing a strategy for national health security that promotes resilient communities and healthcare systems coordinating and working together before, during, and after disasters. Dr. Nicole Laurie, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response at HHS, describes the mission of our office.
The Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response is relatively new and was formed out of a lesson learned from Hurricane Katrina. That, in fact, it was the, I think, very wise opinion of many that all of the emergency response functions needed to be consolidated in one place. And in some place, there was, in some ways, there was a place the buck needed to stop here, that somebody needed to take responsibility from beginning to end for all that happened or might happen. And so the office was created at that time. It had a predecessor organization or two, one obviously dealing with the National Disaster Medical System that's been around for a very long time, and the other dealing with the need to develop medical countermeasures after 9/11 and the anthrax attacks. So first and foremost is a policy advising and coordination role that we do for the secretary. Secondly, we are responsible for the secretary's operations center and for the medical response components of an emergency. So under that, the National Disaster Medical System and other components exist. And if a community or state is overwhelmed and asks for federal assistance in one way or another, then the National Disaster Medical System kicks in and helps out. And then thirdly, we are responsible for what's called the advanced development and procurement of medical countermeasures for the strategic national stockpile. And those can be anything from flu vaccine for a pandemic or, for that matter, an H1N1, or countermeasures or vaccines against more traditional biothreats like smallpox or anthrax or botulism. So it's really a tripartite mission in a sense, and it makes it an exciting place to work because it's a place where science and medicine and public health and policy all come together.
It's an exciting yet challenging place to work. Dr. Nicole Lorre continues.
You know, first, overall, the mission, building a resilient nation and a culture of preparedness, is a challenge because most people in our country don't feel threatened day to day, fortunately. So building that culture of resilience and the culture of preparedness, number one challenge. Dealing with a public health infrastructure that is somewhat in disrepair and that is continuing to lose jobs around the country is counter to what we try to do in building a nation that's prepared. And so dealing with the political and budget realities on the ground, second big challenge. And thirdly, I think sustaining a national commitment to preparedness. People's memories are short. When something happens, they want to know, why haven't you done something about it, and what have you done to be ready, and why aren't you at the ready all the time? But as you get distant from any disaster, people's memories wane, the funding goes down, and their support to maintain it is less. And so then we constantly have to pay catch up. And that's not a very efficient way to run anything. And so keeping the nation focused and that commitment to preparedness is really important. I would say on the management side, because our mission is broad as it is, we've got very different cultures within the organization. We have a culture of scientists is very different than a culture of responders and is very different from a culture of policymakers. And their worldviews are different. Their approach to thinking and problem solving is different. It's what makes it a lot of fun, but it also makes it challenging.
Some say all things worth doing are challenging. Dr. Nicole Lorre, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response at HHS, explains national health security and how we can get there as a country.
Well, what I would say is that disasters take many forms and they affect all of us. We like to think that national health security is achieved when our country and all of our communities together are prepared to respond and recover from the health impacts of emergencies. To do this, you need strong, modern, nimble health and emergency response systems. You also need to have resilient people. And so that means, ideally, that you have people who are healthy. Prevention becomes very important. You can't have people who are worried about their health every day or health insecure. So on the one hand, we focus and very much support the prevention and health promotion missions of our department to help our country be better and stronger. And on the other hand, we really want to focus on building resilience so that people can recover from health emergencies faster.
That's a critical strategy for promoting resilience. But how important is it to strengthen the national public health and preparedness response and recovery capability? Dr. Lorre explains.
All disasters are local. And so local response and state response is always going to come first. And people rely first on their families and communities, and then on their state government, and then on the federal government to get these done in a series of interlocking pieces. A preparedness system or preparedness and response and recovery are not only the purview of government. They are the purview of everybody. And it's really being sure that everybody can come together, that everybody has a part, they know what part they play, and that you can conduct that orchestra, as it will, you know, in an event That's the most important. But everybody has a role.
The echo of everyone has a role resonates with Vice Admiral Matthew Nathan, Surgeon General of the U.S. Navy and leader of its Bureau of Medicine and Surgery, which has a long and cherished tradition of serving and safeguarding the health of its service members and their families. In fact, the foundation of Navy medicine is Force Health Protection. That is ensuring the availability of a medically ready, healthy, and fit force.
I like to tell people our medical service is really responsible for providing care above the ocean in aviation, on the ocean in our surface Navy, below the ocean in our submarine force, and then on land as we support the Marines and the special operators such as SEAL groups and EOD groups. So we have a pretty wide portfolio that's developed throughout the years. And our job is really one of two missions, and it's one to be ready. And when people ask me what business I'm in, I like to tell them I'm in the readiness business. My job is to be ready for the next improvised explosive device that goes off in Afghanistan. My job is to be ready for the next mom who's gone into labor and needs her delivery at the threshold of one of our hospitals. I consider both to be paramount in readiness.
As Admiral Nathan describes, Navy medicine must perform from the sea to the land, the toughest environments, across a spectrum of military missions. But to do it successfully requires a strategic vision and core priorities.
We've tried to be as concise and succinct as possible with our strategic vision. And it starts with readiness. Readiness is job one for us. As we've talked about before, that's the business I'm in. I'm expected to be able to answer the bell anywhere, anytime around the world. The second is value. And value comes back to the point where we have to constantly be analyzing what we do, how we do it, and how much bang for the buck. I tell my people it's really sort of a fraction described as quality times capability divided by cost. I have to constantly be analyzing that. Whatever we do, we're going to do first class and safely, but let's make sure our portfolio includes only those things that really bring value to our system. And then the third is joint. I need my people to start thinking more and more joint. I call it a Reese's peanut butter cup, where one hospital brought the chocolate, the other brought the peanut butter. We put them together, and we have this synergy of best practices that occurred. I've seen the utility and the value of doing things jointly. In addition, it doesn't make good business sense for the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy to have three different medical systems that use three different types of, for instance, IMIT technologies, pharmaceutical systems, education training systems. Why not figure out a way to standardize those, create best practices, share those among the services, reduce redundancies, and create more jointness?
To make his strategic vision a reality requires a strong command philosophy. Vice Admiral Matthew Nathan describes.
I tell my people I believe in ship, shipmate, and self. And in the Navy, we say you've got to take care of the ship, because if you don't and you lose the ship, nothing else matters. You yourself are now lost and the mission is lost. Shipmate, we've got to look after each other. I think one of the reasons I've stayed in the military for a career And I trained in an academic residency, a non-military residency, so I've maintained great friendships with people I trained with, you know, over 30 years ago. But one of the things I've enjoyed is the covenant relationship that we have with our people. The fact that our job is to monitor their health, monitor how their welfare, and to, and some would say intrude when necessary, to help people through situations and take care of them when they're not doing well. And that's a shipmate taking care of a shipmate. And then self, taking care of yourself, raising your hand when you need help, letting people know if you're not doing well, letting people know if you need help either because of a personal issue or a professional one. You can't handle what you've been asked to do, and raise your hand and do it. So I've tried very hard to create a non-stigma, guilt-free environment where somebody can raise their hand and say, I need help, where somebody can be constantly vigilant about the people they work around and notice subtle or dramatic changes, and recognize that they have to take care of the mission around them.
Vice Admiral Matthew Nathan, Surgeon General of the U.S. Navy, offers some interesting advice to those thinking about a career in public service, such as medicine or the armed forces.
I think anybody who wants to go into medicine or the healthcare professions, you know, already has sort of defined themselves as somebody who wants to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And so I would tell any young person today, first of all, I think the health professions are a noble noble occupation and profession because you're putting service above self. And secondly, if you want to do it in the venue of the federal healthcare system, in my case, the military healthcare system, I think you'd be very surprised at the numbers of opportunities and the dynamic range that you can practice in. So I would commend that to anybody, recognizing that for some people, you may come in and do this for a little while, and for others, you may do it for quite a while. But I think it's a way to give back. I think it's a way to put service above self. I think it's a way to feel, as you could in any profession, I don't care what it is, as long as you've given your all to it and done it altruistically, that at the end of the day, you've made a difference. And that's what I tell young people.
Next up are Profiles in Leadership, when this special edition of the Business of Government magazine returns. What is fast government, and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How are VA and HUD working to end chronic homelessness among veterans? What is national health security, and how do we get there as a country? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Over the last 6 months, I've interviewed a variety of government executives who manifest the leadership and commitment needed to meet their varied missions. In this edition, we introduce you to three leaders who are changing the way government does business. NASA continues to face significant operational changes, from retiring the shuttle program to transitioning to the next generation space transportation system for exploring beyond low Earth orbit to the exploration of Mars. In seizing these opportunities and meeting such challenges, NASA continues its role as the nation's pioneer in space exploration, scientific discovery, and aeronautics research. And its future is quite bright, according to NASA's Chief Human Capital Officer, Jerry Buchholz.
So NASA was created in October of 1958, and I think people are very familiar with the NASA history. It's part of our U.S. cultural history through the Gemini program, the Apollo program, and the Space Shuttle program. And as your listeners probably know, the Space Shuttle program ended about a year and a half ago. And at that time, people were sort of wondering if there was really a future for NASA. So one of the things that I'm pleased to say today is that indeed the future for NASA is quite bright. We are currently working on the James Webb Telescope, which is a very, very long-range telescope that's being built. We are also working on the new Orion vehicle, which will take astronauts past the moon, and the SLS rocket to launch that. And I think of great interest always is the fact that we have astronauts living and working on the space station 365 days a year.
As NASA's CHECO, Buchholz plays a significant role in keeping the agency's future bright, making sure it has the right people with the right skills in the right roles in order to meet its current and future missions.
I have a really interesting and unique role. So I'm, of course, responsible for overall agency policy, for the overarching executive resources of the agency, and for the IT infrastructure that the human resources business operation runs on. But my most important contribution to the agency mission is the work that I do on workforce culture and ensuring that NASA has the workforce culture, the innovative culture it needs, so that in, you know, at some point in the future, human beings can travel beyond the moon to Mars, and also so that we can engage in our Earth observation activities related to climate and weather, et cetera. It is interesting because culture and working on culture issues is very, very different than HR business operations. And it can be challenging sometimes to keep that sorted out and to really be sure always that the things that you are working on really do address the issue that you're trying to address. But I have to also say that the culture work is, for me at least, by far the more exciting, innovative, creative aspect of the job.
In forging an innovative workforce culture, Buchholz is focusing on three areas.
What we're focusing on to create that environment of innovation, we really focus in three areas. We focus on connecting our people to each other and the mission, which is challenging in times when travel, training, and conferences are receiving a great deal of scrutiny across the federal government. We focus on building what we call model supervisors, those supervisors that display the attributes that we need to lead NASA into the future. And we focus on recognizing and rewarding innovative performance. So as we work on developing our strategy, as we work on implementing our strategy, which we're doing at the same time, we really try to focus our efforts in those three areas.
NASA must be doing something right. It was rated the best place to work among large federal government agencies by the Partnership for Public Service, based on results from its annual survey of government employees.
And I have to say that I am just so very, very proud of the NASA workforce. That was not an easy transition for people to make. It was not an easy transition for the agency itself to make or for the agency's culture to make. But we knew we had succeeded when we were ranked the best large agency in the federal government by the Partnership for Public Service, largely based on our scores that our employees gave us on employee engagement. So we were going through a major transformation of our agency mission, end of a 30-year program, you know, going forward in a completely new and different direction. Many people wrote us off. Many people expected our results to tank. And in fact, that wouldn't be an unreasonable outcome to expect under such difficult circumstances. First, we made sure that we told people that their opinion matters, that we want to know what they think because we want to work to make the organization the best organization that we can make it, given our circumstances, certainly. The second thing that we did is what I call connecting the dots. The other thing is the mistake that I see other agencies make is they focus on 12 things. So nothing gets the direct attention that it needs. My best advice is focus on one or two things that really matter to your workforce. Tell them that their opinion matters and connect the dots back to the feedback that you've received.
The Obama administration's recently proposed budget calls for more investment in the nation's public buildings. These investments, according to the administration, will enable GSA's public buildings service to properly maintain and improve the real estate assets owned and paid for by the American people. Dorothy Robine, commissioner of PBS, explains its mission.
The Public Building Service is the real estate arm of the federal government. People refer to us as the landlord to the civilian agencies. I don't usually use the L word, though. We have a total of 375 million square feet of space. And it's roughly half federally owned space and half leased space, actually. It's a little bit more leased than owned, a total of about 9,600 buildings, and they're distributed throughout the country and territories of the United States. We are very much of a regional organization. There are 11 regions, and they correspond pretty much to the divisions of the courts or other federal agencies. The largest is the National Capital Region. About a quarter of all of our space is in the National Capital Region, not surprisingly. That's where a lot of federal buildings are. And then 10 other regions, and the regions report up through the central office, my office. And then I report to Dan Tangerlini, the head of GSA.
As PBS commissioner, Robine oversees the work performed by these offices, as well as directs resources, manages stakeholder expectation, and most of all, sets strategic direction for the office. Though the job is challenging under normal circumstances, Robine took the helm in the aftermath of congressional investigations about mismanagement and has worked with acting GSA administrator Dan Tangerlini to address many of the issues facing PBS. In tackling these pressing issues, challenges remain.
The two overarching challenges are the budget and the organizational structure of PBS. The budget is a huge challenge because the last 3 years we have not gotten access to all of the money coming into the federal building fund. In fact, we have not gotten access to about $1 billion to $1.5 billion each year. So that's a significant amount. The amount of money going into the federal building fund is money that I feel I should be reinvesting in buildings. I charge commercial rates to our federal customers for those buildings, and I feel that I owe it to them and to taxpayers to be putting that money back into our buildings. the last couple of years, $1 billion to $1.5 billion a year has been diverted from the Federal Building Fund into other activities. So Dan Tangerlini's and my biggest challenge is to try to get PBS back on a solid budget footing, meaning getting access to all of the funds coming into the Federal Building Fund to support our activities. We have a huge backlog of unmet repair and maintenance needs, including fire life safety issues, because we have not gotten access to that funding. So getting us back on a solid budget footing is absolutely critical to the future of PBS. I don't see how the organization can continue to function effectively if we don't get back on a solid budget footing.
The second overarching challenge facing Robine is the organizational structure of PBS. For her, it's all about arranging the organization the best way in order to make it successful.
What PBS does is inherently very local in nature. We build, maintain, operate buildings. Buildings are very, very local. So the work that we do is inherently very, very local. But not everything that we do needs to be done in 11 places. And that is the way that that we're currently organized. But I think now we're dealing with perhaps an excess of regional autonomy. I think that may have contributed to the problems of a year ago that brought Dan and me into the organization.
There's a strong culture in GSA for promoting property disposal. The biggest impediments, Robine points out, are the upfront cost of getting rid of property, various legal requirements, and stakeholder interest. The administration has proposed the creation of a civilian equivalent to the Defense Base Closure and Realignment, or BRAC, process. The beauty of the BRAC process, according to Robine, is that there is an independent commission that looks at a variety of alternatives and identifies the best options. Congress then can vote up or down on these options. They cannot cherry-pick. It's all or nothing. In the end, moving PBS forward is Robine's ultimate mission.
I think GSA generally, but PBS has a particularly important role to play in the coming years because agencies are looking to reduce their budgets, and space is an area, just like in the private sector, where they can do that, and we can help them do that.
Brian Sivak, Chief Technology Officer at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, completes our profiles by detailing his efforts to advance collaboration and innovation within his department. HHS sits atop a vast array of data, information, and expertise that, if leveraged and properly applied innovatively, could transform health and healthcare delivery within this country. With advances in technology and the development of various collaborative platforms, we are witnessing a prime opportunity to make a vision of the future a reality today.
One of the interesting things about my job in particular is that I actually have two titles. One title is Chief Technology Officer. The other title is Entrepreneur in Residence. And in many ways, I actually think the EIR side of my title is a little more descriptive of what I actually do. One thing I've learned over time, and I say this as a technologist and as a big geek, right, and somebody who loves technology and thinks that, you know, usually jumps to a technology solution is the first one because it's just how my brain works. But one of the things I've learned over time is that technology is rarely a solution to a problem. Technology can be an enabler. It can be a catalyst. It can be an accelerant. But it often needs to be sort of layered on top of some more fundamental change, which would be usually culture change or process change.
Since becoming CTO, Sivak has sought to change both culture and processes in an institution of almost 80,000 staff and a budget well into the hundreds of billions. No small feat, but given that Sivak is only the second CTO in HHS history, it further underscores the ambitiousness of his vision.
And so that's where I think the EIR side of my job comes in. And a lot of what we're focusing on right now is how to actually affect cultural change within the department so that we can put technology on top of it and actually make things better.
The key for Brian Sivak is experimenting. That is, finding things that work even if they are slightly outside the box. But this motivation goes beyond data.
How do we recognize the value in people? This is tricky, because what this really means is culture change. And culture change is probably the hardest thing that you'll ever attempt to do. You know, it's easy to, you know, throw a piece of technology on top of something and hope that it works. It's much, much harder to get people to change. Change is hard. So what we're doing is really approaching this from a somewhat systematic perspective, building a framework of a series of programs that will hopefully get us to this sort of overarching goal.
Sivak has crafted a series of programs to facilitate culture change across HHS. Fostering collaboration is critical to it all. In the history of disruptive innovation, there are very few eureka moments, he admits, what tends to happen is really a culmination of years of people collectively collaborating on a problem. CVAC is fond of using a term coined by Tony Hsieh, Zappos CEO, called serendipitous collision. Enabling serendipitous collision involves changing the physical workspaces at HHS, as well as architecting virtual collaboration platforms.
One of the things that we're looking at doing is creating actually a physical space called HHS Labs, which think about it like a Silicon Valley style co-working space where, you know, all of the furniture is modular, there are no walls, every surface is writable. And I'm not talking about building some crazy expensive thing out here. I'm talking about, you know, going to IKEA and buying some cheap furniture on wheels that you can push around. And you know, it doesn't matter if it gets dinged up, right? We're not talking about building something fancy. We're talking about building something with low barrier to connection. So that's one side of it. Then the other side is what I'll call a virtual collaboration space. So about 6 months ago, we launched a internal collaboration network across the department. We had the secretary announce it to sort of give her validation that this is something that we wanted to do. We've been working to increase adoption and engagement on this. Again, this is, you know, it's hard. It's culture change. But we've seen some pretty remarkable stuff start to happen. You know, people asking questions that would not have normally asked questions, or people at various levels in the department interacting that never would have interacted before. And so these are great things.
Brian Sivak also wants to identify early adopters within the department. To do this, he has launched two programs, HHS Ignite and HHS Fair Trade.
What we're looking at trying to do is trying to help connect people who have ideas but need resources to implement those ideas, not necessarily money, but mainly people and skills.
This desire goes beyond the borders of the department. Sivak's looking to attract entrepreneurial talent from the outside, which has two benefits.
We have essentially some hand-selected high-risk, high-reward projects that exist across the department. And when I say hand-selected, I mean the secretary will select the things that she thinks are important. And what we then do is bring external people in for a period of a year, no more, no less, to actually work on solving these problems. And that has two benefits. One, we get new ideas into the mix that we probably wouldn't have otherwise. Number two, you have some people that are not necessarily bound by some of the bureaucratic handcuffs that folks on the inside are, and are able to prove that there are better ways of doing things. And so this is sort of a, you know, injecting new concepts into the mix.
HHS has sponsored challenge competitions as part of the America Competes Act as another way to inject external ideas and dynamism into the department. Bringing in new ideas and new people can go a long way towards changing an institution's culture, but the support of risk-taking and experimentation can directly affect the behavior of your staff.
We believe that if we can, you know, implement these programs and then track, you know, their progress, we will be able to start to affect this idea of culture change across the department.
Next up, perspectives on ending veteran homelessness when the special edition of the Business of Government magazine returns. What is fast government, and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How are changing work habits and technology decreasing the federal government's real estate footprint? And how are VA and HUD working to end chronic homelessness among veterans? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We go beyond the buzz to introduce and connect our readers to actual public sector executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org.
What is NASA's human capital and workforce strategy? How is NASA tackling the human capital challenges that it is facing? What is NASA doing to develop future leaders and pursue a strategic workforce planning approach? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and so much more with Jerry Buchholz, Chief Human Capital Officer at NASA. That's next week on the Business of Government Hour. Tune in every Monday at 11 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Welcome back to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. All across America, small towns and large cities are facing the social realities of homelessness and the steady increase of and demand for homeless services. Sadly, our country's veterans have been more likely than most Americans to experience homelessness, in part because of their high rates of post-traumatic stress disorder, physical injuries and disabilities, and many other factors. While providing shelter and services to those most in need is critical, the national conversation is shifting from managing to ending homelessness, especially chronic homelessness among veterans. Several years ago, the federal government made a commitment to prevent and end veteran homelessness by 2015. To make this goal a reality would require the breaking down of institutional silos and increasing collaboration between two federal agencies. In an effort to confront this seemingly intractable issue, two federal departments, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs and the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, have joined together to strategically align their resources and coordinate efforts to end veteran homelessness. We present the perspectives of two key leaders directly involved in this cross-agency collaboration, Susan Angel from VA and Mark Johnston from HUD. Both bring an exacting combination of practical knowledge and an understanding of the work to be done and the progress achieved to date. Please note that since this interview, Ms. Angel is retired from public service. Here's Mark Johnston on setting context and a comprehensive national strategy to prevent and end veteran homelessness.
Well, let me give just some brief context here, and that is for years, the federal government has been trying to confront homelessness, but this is the first time that we've ever actually had a strategic plan to end it. In the past, we've tried to manage it, we've tried to address it, but we've never been committed to actually ending homelessness. And so the 19 agencies that make up the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, which have great leadership from the VA and HUD, and other agencies are very involved as well, really got their arms around the fact that there are various subpopulations of the homeless that we need to focus on if we're going to strategically end this problem. So the goals include ending chronic homelessness, that's persons living on the streets or in shelters for long periods of time who are disabled. There's ending veteran homelessness, ending family and children homelessness. And then the last goal was simply, not even frankly that simply, but to help set the path for ending all other forms of homelessness. So there's some folks that don't fit into those categories, such as single individuals that don't have disability. But our primary focus is chronic homelessness, veteran homelessness, and family and youth homelessness.
Susan Angel, formerly from VA, identifies the characteristics of the homeless veteran population.
Homeless veterans are typically males between the ages of 31 and 61, and they have many risk factors for homelessness. First, poverty, lack of good health and support services, unemployment, a lack of access to affordable housing. They might have disabling psychological conditions like post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury, domestic violence, military sexual trauma, drug and alcohol issues, physical and mental illness, past history of incarceration, a difficult transition from active duty service. But of all of the risk factors that I've mentioned, poverty is the number one risk factor. Another unique factor for veterans, they are usually entering the homeless service provision area by themselves. They don't come with families or partners. They are by themselves. So quite a bit of isolation.
Mark Johnston from HUD explains the benefit of pursuing a housing-first approach to ending veteran homelessness.
Well, the concept of Housing First came about from an outreach worker in New York City named Sam Simberis, who was, when he was engaging homeless persons and was trying to help stabilize them so they could move into, for instance, emergency shelter, kept getting these responses that, I don't want to go to shelter. I don't want to get stabilized. I want a house. And so he changed his thinking and therefore his program in terms of what he was going to do. And the concept of Housing First is really get people housed first and then focus on everything else. Because once you're housed, one of our most basic needs in life, then you can start focusing on the other issues around you, such as perhaps your drug abuse or mental health issues. So at first, many groups were skeptical of this approach. Even HUD was concerned. And so we did a national study to get a sense of how well it did work. And we were quite impressed with the results that, in fact, about 84% of all chronically homeless persons, that's persons living on the streets with a mental illness, were still housed a year after they got placed immediately into their own apartments. And so we really have been touting that with the VA for 4 years now, that this really is the solution for people that need long-term permanent housing.
Johnson and Angel explain the importance of the HUD Veteran Affairs Supportive Housing Program, or HUDBASH, to their collective efforts.
It is a wonderful, unique program across, I think, all of government in that this is the only instance I know of where two federal agencies jointly administer a single program. So we use our expertise of knowing how to provide rental assistance, and we rely on the VA for a lot in terms of providing outreach to the veterans, clinical services. So we do the housing and VA does the services. And we've proven that it works really, really well, especially for people living on the streets and have been homeless for a very long period of time. So the Congress, who we jointly developed this with many years ago, has given us a lot of flexibility on how to use it and have given us support each and every year. Even through these tough, tough budget times, we continue to get an appropriation for that particular program.
The HUD-VASH program has probably been one of our most effective ways to end veteran homelessness. It really is the housing part of ending homelessness that VA does not have the authority to provide. So this partnership makes it possible. We currently have about 48,000 vouchers to use, and because of our joint efforts, we have housed 41,000 veterans in these HUD-VASH units. At this point in time, we're targeting our HUD-VASH resources to our most chronically most in-need veterans. It's also a great asset for us for those homeless veterans that may not quite fit in transitional housing or other programs like single parents with kids. It's a great option for single parents with kids.
As they say, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So how has HUD's Homeless Prevention Rapid Rehousing Program made a difference?
Where we were able to serve about 1.3 million people over the course of 3 years, which was a huge program to stand up. It was $1.5 billion. And we learned a lot of lessons. And I think the two most important lessons that I learned from this was twofold. First of all, and you heard from that name, it's kind of long. It's two concepts. It's homelessness prevention and rapid rehousing. Rapid rehousing simply means if somebody becomes homeless, let's rapidly rehouse them back into an apartment. We can pay the rent for a little while. We can pay the utilities for a little while. We can even help with some case management for a little while. And we let the communities decide how long that's going to be. It might be 3 or 4 months. It might be a year. And what we found was that most homeless people that we helped needed a very small amount of investment to solve their homeless problem. So much so, in fact, that after a year, 90% of all the families assisted that we've seen across the country were still housed. And the cost was only about $1,200 per person. So that was a huge aha moment for HUD, and I think for the VA as well, is that we don't have to have a really expensive intervention for every homeless person. We need to have dosages of interventions where if you're living on the streets for years, you're probably going to need permanent housing and a lot of services for some time to come. But for most homeless people, they will not need nearly that much intervention. The second important lesson, and one that was kind of surprising for me, was rapid rehousing is an incredibly cost-effective and efficient intervention. And prevention is something we don't want to use targeted homeless dollars for. We can see bigger mainstream programs targeting that a lot more. That's their role, as mainstream welfare programs. So going forward with our existing programs, we're really encouraging communities to use our limited, very limited resources for rapid rehousing and less so for homelessness prevention.
Susan Angel tells us more about what VA is doing to raise awareness of these programs available to at-risk vets.
We have had a campaign effort called Make the Call. Mm-hmm. We have a 24/7 call center for homeless veterans. And we went across the country. Our top leadership hit 28 cities in 2 weeks and did radio, TV, ribbon cuttings, stand downs, all to talk about this call center and Make the Call. Probably one of our biggest asset for outreach are our vet centers. We have 300 vet centers across the nation, and they're primarily staffed by fellow combat veterans. These vet centers also have mobile vet centers. These mobile vet centers are these great big bus things, and they're equipped with offices and technology such that they can go out to an event and provide care, provide counseling, get someone eligible and into the VA system of care. They can also take those mobile vet centers and go out into our very rural areas on a regular basis to make sure that not just expecting veterans to come to us, but we're reaching out to veterans and making sure we reach them. The other thing that we do are stand downs. Mm-hmm. We have stand downs across the country, and it's an event, usually once a year, 1 or 2 or 3 days, where the entire community comes together, the VA, the local service provider, social services, whatever a veteran might need, food, shelter, clothing, health screenings, all those things are available at a stand down.
In the end, it's all about breaking down the institutional silos that exist and permitting folks to collaborate. So how has HUD and VA used a shared leadership model in order to end veterans' homelessness? Susan Angel explains.
Well, breaking down the silos within government is critically important, and I think is really the foundation of our success. We have a shared leadership that's very important to both of our organizations. It's so important that both of our secretaries, Secretary Shinseki and Secretary Donovan, have agreed to form a 2-year leadership team for the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness. And this facilitates long-term planning and goal setting for the 19 members of this agency. So this is the first time this has happened, and it really shows how closely we are working together, and there isn't a silo between VA and HUD. We also support the shared leadership by reviewing data together. We develop joint interventions in communities that are struggling. We team up for opportunities like this so we can jointly get the message out to people that government is working together as a team to solve a very critical social problem in our country. We do things like joint briefings to Congress. Mm-hmm. Everything we can do together, we do it.
Stay tuned as we wrap up this edition of the Business of Government magazine with insights on reshaping public human service delivery when this special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns. What is fast government, and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How can serendipitous collision change the way agencies do business? How are changing work habits and technology decreasing the federal government's footprint? Get your latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We go beyond the buzz to introduce and connect our readers to actual public sector executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Get your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. During the year, I often speak with leaders who are using innovative approaches to push current limits and transform the way things are being done. The country's human service system is now on an unsustainable path. Its operations are too fragmented, too focused on process, and too inefficient to deliver on outcomes. The system must move in new directions, down new pathways, if it is to meet increased demand for assistance at a time of tight budgets and heightened expectations. Here's Tracy Waring, Executive Director of the American Public Human Services Association, on the mission of her organization.
We're a bipartisan nonprofit membership organization. We represent public sector human service agencies at the state and local level through their top-level executives and their senior leadership. And what that really means is that there are government agencies in states and in local jurisdictions that provide nutrition assistance programs, aging and disability services, child welfare, and other types of supports. And those agencies and their leadership come to us to support their work as a membership association. Our mission is to pursue excellence in human services by supporting our member agencies, informing and working with national policymakers in particular, and working with partners to drive integrated and efficient solutions in policy and practice.
Many of the challenges human service providers face today reflect the current landscape in which they operate, and yet they see challenges as well as opportunities. Tracy Waring elaborates.
Well, I think, you know, almost all of the challenges today could be described in the current landscape in which we're operating. There are a lot of opportunities in there as well, and I'll touch upon how we think about that. But the challenges really are that there is a current trajectory, largely because of the weak economy that we've had in this country for the last several years, that's put us on what many would say is an unsustainable path. And when you think about the fact that human services are largely supports for low-income populations or folks who may have lost their job or who need assistance to make sure that they've got food on the table for their children, when you have